Might not be possible, you see. There might be 80% of you who don't. But I'm going to try during this Congress to clear you. Just that. Just... And let's hope afterwards we don't have to say, well, he made a good try. But we have, in SOPHC, and a few other little tricks, which I have in this one and in this sleeve over here, techniques which reduce Dianetics and Scientology to a straight wire process. Fantastic, isn't it? All these years, and the first thing you know, we can do it by straight wire. You don't even have to ask the right question. If you ask the wrong one often enough, he'll still get cleared. A little bit later in these lectures, I will go over the formulas and axioms which lie behind this material. But right now, it's best that we simply take the material itself. And the first of this material is Scientology itself and what it is doing or what it is trying to do, what it hopes to do. It is a process whereby you can make your own goals come true. Your goals actually are not too different or too strange from the goals of another human being. All these things have a difference. One person wants to be a streetcar conductor and the other one wants to be a painter. But what are they doing, both of them? They're trying to live, to be happy, to help their fellow man. Now, that's about all they're trying to do, really, basically. When they become extremely aberrated, when people have told them often enough, and when they themselves have told themselves often enough, that they are unable to reach their own goals anymore, or that these goals are undesirable or unattainable, an individual then gets into a condition where he has to play it all for himself, where he has to cheat himself and others, where he has to pretend that he's the only one in existence, and where he cannot admit into fellowship with himself other men, other women, and so he gets into a very lonely state of mind, which in itself seems to be born from the fact that he cannot trust other people, and that other people are, quote, no good, unquote, or that ARC itself is a very undesirable thing to have. And he believes that the universe is a trap, and he believes that he himself has no future whatsoever. And all this actually stems from the fact that he has become convinced that he cannot survive. An individual who knows he can't survive is a very dangerous fellow. Even a rat in a corner will fight. And when an individual knows that he is in a corner, just like a rat, he'll fight. And most importantly, he will very often act like a rat. The horrible thing about it is that he can't fail to survive, and this is the one fact that he hides from himself. It is utterly impossible for him to do anything but survive. That's hideous, isn't it? If you stop to think of 18 billion millennia yet coming before you, and that you'll survive every instant of it, whether you like it or not, you'll start to invent ways and means and reasons to convince yourself, as well as others, that you can't survive. Naturally, this is very desirable, not to survive, because if you survived that long, you would become terribly bored. I processed a pre-clear the other day who had been bored for 18,000 years. I started to run boredom on him and discovered something quite interesting. This pre-clear uniformly had escaped the auditor during each and every session simply by getting up off the couch and leaving the moment boredom was even vaguely touched, or the moment when he himself felt bored. So we took some tenpenny nails a large hammer, nailed him down. Put a guard with a sawed-off shotgun at the door and ran boredom on him. I would actually much rather try to tame a wildcat than to run boredom on a person who is really pretty bad off on the subject. It's dangerous. He claws. There's a horrible, sickening feeling that at any moment he's going to burst all apart or melt into some horrible glutinous mass, or he just can't stand it. And to cap that, of course, he can't stand it. But the point is that boredom itself would seem to be the great enemy rather than fear. If you had fear as an enemy, it would be the fear of boredom. That's why people look at TV, they'll do practically anything. Even look at TV to keep from being bored. Here you have man's thirst to be in effect. And you have, more importantly, his thirst to be good and dead when he's dead. One of the rights man should have is to be permitted to be dead when he's dead. If you went out and you'd think offhand that if we had this as a popular slogan, you know, something we were going to campaign with throughout the country, that it wouldn't get any votes. Let me assure you, it would get more votes than the president. When a man's dead, let him be dead. Everybody'd sort of react to this strangely, and they'd say, that's a goofy thing. That's a horrible thing that's very strange, kind of a slogan, but, you know, there's some truth in it, I'm sure of that. You know, you take some fellow, he isn't pretty anymore, he has no allure for the ladies anymore, he's in horrible condition, he's run over by a truck and all messed up, and he hasn't got any legs anymore or something of the sort, and they take him up to a hospital and give him an anesthesia and patch him up. And they say, you're going to live, fella. He's expected to receive this as good news. Well, in Scientology, it has happened more than once now that an individual has come to a Scientologist, has been exteriorized, nicely, stably exteriorized, with good perception of the mesh universe, whose body was in very poor condition, and who was then gone home after the session, and within 2 or 3 days has been good and dead. That's strange, isn't it? People would think offhand that that which cured people, of course, would make them live. But that isn't true. That which cured the individual, that's fine. That would let him live. But what is the individual? Is the body the individual? Well, because the market value of bodies is pretty good. Market value of bodies is pretty fair these days. It costs $63 to give them a little handy Jim Dandy economy-sized funeral. It costs quite a bit of money to put one through college. So on the market value of bodies is very high. But the market value of the individual is very, very low. He hasn't anything to sell at all. And as a result, why, he starts trading in bodies. And then you, as an auditor, do something for this individual, and he all of a sudden finds that he himself has a market value to himself. He is worth something at last without having to carry a body around, or he has an opportunity to get a body, and we get this perfectly logical sequence. He takes the body home and knocks it off. Now, that's happened several times. And just out of meanness, viciousness, just so that I would have an exhibit now and then, I have knocked out of a precare who really should have gone home and knocked his body off. I've processed out the desire to do so. Vicious. It's a vicious streak I have in me. Sometimes it just comes out. I see somebody and I say, so they want to die on me. Huh? They're going to die right here in the office. I'm going to exteriorize them and then they're going to knock the body. No, they're not. So I take out of them the desire to knock the body off. See? And then they go home. and sometimes go on for a long time. Well, that sounds utterly mad, doesn't it? If the public at large was to have heard me making those remarks, they would have said, my goodness, what do we have here? This is the most strange talk that we have heard in a long, long time, and something should be done about that. And yet they go down and they hear the Reverend Witherspoon down at the corner of the First Methodist or something of the sort, and he says, God hates you, but he really doesn't hate you because he loves you, because Christ died for all of your sins, and your sins are all forgiven to you because Christ died for them, and that's why you're being punished for them now. And they see nothing strange in this. They sit there very intently and listen to this and decide that they have been enlightened. Well, maybe they've been enlightened, but so has a burned-out match. It's been enlightened, too. The main difficulty with an individual who is so utterly on the subject of religion, for instance, is that religion is going to save his soul and expects him to save his soul. Every once in a while, you'll get a preacher who's in pretty foul condition, and he'll start talking about my Satan. He'll say, my Satan is over there. That's a very interesting remark. My Satan is over there. This is the same level if he said, I'm over there. And you say, no, you're not. You're right where you are. No, I'm not where I am. I am on the other side of the room from where I am. That's where I am. You'd think there was something wrong with him, wouldn't you? Supposing you walked into an insurance office, something like that, and the boss man there kept insisting that he was out in the outer office, and you were talking to him at the desk, but he says, no, I'm out in the outer office all the time. You'd think this was real peculiar. Well, the person who says, my Satan, continually, is actually carrying on this dramatization of my soul. I'm going to save my soul in come hell or high water, and I'm not going to let it burn forever. Whatever it is, it's a peculiar thing. He's identified himself with a piece of energy. He's identified himself with a set of symbols, and he's done this to such a degree that he no longer has an idea of self. The idea of self is gone. It's something like it's a body, it's a name, it's almost anything, it's a dog tag, it's a set of fingerprints down at the Federal Boys Institute in Washington. They have numerous categories which tells him what he is, but he isn't any of these things. Who is he? He's himself. And as himself, he is dead as long as he has no dreams for himself as himself. And he is alive as long as he has goals and dreams for himself as himself. And in Scientology, it is possible for an individual to discover himself. And that should be his first goal. The discovery of self is a very easily accomplished thing these days. There are some resistive fives who don't believe really this is true. They see the logical force of argument in what we say. They see the beauty of the logic. And they agree thoroughly upon the desirability of such a state of affairs, but at the same time, they just can't get 3 feet back of their heads. Well, now, it's not too difficult to do that with modern techniques. The point is, an individual at that moment becomes disabused of many data, and the most of these data consist of a name, a body, a this, a that. He has goals for other things, but he has no goals for himself. Now, you could say that to somebody, and it would seem very sad to him. You'd say, well, here was a little boy, and he had goals for his daddy and his mama and for everybody else, but he didn't have any goals for himself at all. He didn't know where he was going. He hardly knew he was there at all, and everything he did in the world was being done for something else, and there was nothing could be done for him. You've just about described the Satan. The term Thetan, of course, is one which is derived as a mathematical symbol, derived from that symbol, and is an effort to have a precise word which will describe a precise thing, the unit of beingness, which is the individual. Theta is a Greek letter, and you know mathematicians, they can't talk English, so they use Greek symbols, and mathematicians long since have picked on theta as a symbol which they commonly used, and the Greeks used it to symbolize thought. And so we have theta, thought, mathematical symbol, and then we just put thetan on it, and we have something which could describe at once, but doesn't describe really, the human soul, a ghost, a spirit, a saint, a god, an individual, a being. It's one of these nice big group words. Why? Because it is the word which describes the energy space production unit, which is the individual himself. Now, the burden of proof of any such techniques depends entirely upon being able to execute the problem properly. The burden of proof, then, is entirely upon whether or not an individual cannot, and whether or not all individuals do not respond to technologies which permit them to exteriorize and suddenly stand there looking at their body with a great deal of certainty, knowing absolutely that they are not their body, and wondering how the dickens they got into all that. Well, now, that would be the burden of proof. Is it true, then, that the thetan is the individual, or is this just some sort of delusion that the person gets into and struggles around with or something? Well, it's not any question about it. It's not one of these things you wouldn't put a big brick of ice cream up here on the stage and then try to convince everybody that it was a horse. I mean, there is your level of demonstration. An ice brick of ice cream is not a horse. An individual is not a body. We have that. That's very plain. And an individual who is processed in the direction of not becoming a body exceeds in the first little while of processing all goals of all psychotherapies of the past. So we're not interested in psychotherapy because we exceed its goals. I mean, psychotherapy, let's all play blocks. Let's do something interesting. We talk about the mind, the human mind. I frankly don't think it exists. It's a good mock-up. Wonderful mock-up. I knew a fellow one time who almost committed suicide because he failed his psychology examinations. And his psychology examinations consisted of nothing more nor less than naming the various parts of the brain. And he knew them all. He knew every one of them. And he sat down to write them all. And what do you know? They just sort of left his mind at that moment. Now, that's one of the neatest tricks. If you were a witch doctor on the shores of Jambula and you wanted to get your tribe into a wonderful state of disrepair so that your tribe after that would zing every time you said zing and zam every time you said zam, if you wanted to do that, all you'd have to do is invent something like psychology. Name the parts of the human brain so as to know what a person is thinking about. Uh-oh. You mean interiorize or introvert all the attention of the individual? Isn't that the same thing? All right, let's make him look into that body and put his attention on the body and hold his attention inside the body, and let's stick him real good. And let's stick him fine so that someday somebody will take him to a hospital and put him on an operating table, whack off an arm and leg and fix up his busted nose and throw all of his teeth into the garbage can and patch him up and sew him up and give him some plastic surgery so he looks like some freak, and then say to him, all right, now you'll have to live. Oh no, don't do that to somebody. There's a society way back on the track that nobody could die. They used everybody. I mean, their surgery was so good, their electronics are so good. Somebody suddenly ran out of the ability to move certain joints. They'd cut them open and insert little motors. Wonderful society. But, you could get somebody introverted sufficiently so that he would really stick. And if he really didn't know he was there, and if he was just defending a body, and he knew he didn't really own the body, and the body came from someplace else, and it really belonged to Papa and Mama, and he'd just stolen it. And if he knew all these various things, and he was good and stuck there, you see, why, you could do anything you wanted with him. You know, you could put him on chain gangs, you could make him move blocks for pyramids, and you could have him racing in and out of the wardroom carrying hot and cold water bottles for the admiral. You could have him do anything. And And, well, I was just describing briefly naval service during time of peace. Anyway, the main trick then would be to make an individual be as degraded as possible so that he could be made to serve as slavishly as possible. And the way you'd accomplish that, of course, would make him, would be to make him disappear and make him sort of appear as something else which was in chains. Now, in Scientology, you all of a sudden make the individual appear. You make the Satan appear. You go right on up the line with techniques as you get way on up the line into SOP 8O, which we are not going to take up in this Congress, which builds the individual capability on up the line to a point where he does appear, make things appear. This, of course, would be the freedom coming out, and that's something we mustn't have. Today we had an interesting ruler. I noticed on a coin the other day here in the United States, I noticed this head. It was a head of a fellow, a profile, rather beefy sort of a fellow, and he had this profile, and I looked at it and really realized that 10 or 15 years ago, the country had had a king or something of the sort. So I began to look up historically to find out what had happened in the United States 15, 20 years ago. We had a king Roosevelt or something of the sort. And this fellow was a very interesting chap, a tremendously interesting fellow. He taught the country to have freedom from. That's just too many words. See? Freedom from. Let's just throw that from out of there. Freedom is freedom. It isn't freedom from something. Second, you tell somebody he has freedom from, you're telling him what to be afraid of. And the second you're telling him what to be afraid of, you're telling him where to succumb. Let an individual make up his own mind where he's going to succumb, and he's gotten freedom. But tell him what to fight. And you have not set him free, you'll put him in another set of chains. All right, so we exteriorize the individual. And gradually, little by little, he realizes who he is, what he is. Or he knows it suddenly, as in the form of a kid. You walk up, some little 4 or 5 year old child's been having a tough time in the family, you know, and everybody's playing don't touch with him. That's the main game played with grown ups is don't touch. And you say to this little fellow, you say, now be 3 feet back of your head, and the kid's body sort of goes relaxed. You would make a mistake at that moment if you just didn't keep on talking to him. His hearing points are still on the body. And you just go right on through and process him. You can do this with a baby. But anyway, at the end of this time, you all of a sudden have an individual who has grown considerably in stature. Not as a body, but this individual has more personality. Next time Papa says, get out of here with that and shut up, he would probably say, I beg your pardon. To use an Americanism about pudding, the eating of the pudding depends first upon the havingness of the pudding. You have to have a preclear before you can make this test, or you have to have a body actually to find out whether or not you can exteriorize from one. But the proof of all this simply consists of, do the processes work and do they achieve this? If they achieve this, why, good Lord, we're really on the high road. I mean, man is on the high road at last. Because all of the evils of man come from man's effort to deny freedom to man. His lack of culture is most apparent where slavery has the greatest grip. And where you have men who are free, they can do a lot of things. Work becomes a pleasure. The handling of effort itself becomes a very desirable activity. And things get built. The world becomes more beautiful. Man is able to engage in life as a game rather than as a slavery. And so we get another culture. We don't have a culture which is completely bogged down in a rut and controlled. So, the goals of Scientology would seem to be whatever benefits might stem from restoring a state of freedom and identity to the individual himself, and those would be the goals. There's one thing at work here. We are not arguing about your opinion, and we are not arguing about my opinion. We're not saying man should do this, or the techniques should accomplish that. We're not saying those things. It's all right to say those things, but that isn't what we're saying. We're saying, you say to 50% of the human race, be 3 feet back of your head, and now do this, do this, do this, do this, do this. You all of a sudden have somebody who is well and somebody who has achieved a higher level of freedom. Well, that's all we're talking about. Now, we can achieve that certainty whether we're an accomplished auditor or not today. 50% of the people that you say this to, just do it. The other 45% of the remaining 50% do it after a little work. The remaining 5%, shoot them. No, actually, we don't have to shoot them today. Fortunately, it's like not too long ago, the very, very resistive case was like a horse with a broken leg. You know, the only thing you could do to that horse was shoot him. But we've gotten slings together these days, and the horse can be made to stand up long enough, you see, so that we can exteriorize it. Now, the problem of what we do with Scientology, that is to say, not technically, but what we do with this science as a body of knowledge and as a wide coverage of several fields man has been investigating for a long time. Now, what we do with that body of knowledge, that is something else. Whatever we do with it, that doingness is monitored by the fact that certain results will inevitably accrue from the return of freedom to an individual. Now, these are inescapable. You return freedom to an individual, he no longer has to pretend he is ill. He doesn't have to depend upon many, many things that he did before. He cannot be put into an abject state of terror just because somebody threatens his body with a little pain. He say, go ahead. Go ahead. The hospital's full of mock-ups. I can always pick up another one. He has stepped out beyond force and duress and control. Well, that fact alone monitors what you do with this body of information. The wide use of these technologies today cannot help but bring about a change of culture, whether slowly or swiftly is something else. That factor, to a large degree, depends upon you who are here today. Depends upon the people of the HAS, whether it happens swiftly or slowly. If the central organization is sound, if its principles, if its ethics are good, if its training is the best it can possibly give, it tries to get people as staff and auditors and so forth in the best possible condition, all these things go together. Well, yes, this will happen rather swiftly. You can see results will occur throughout the society. In broken fragments, without any good service unit, or with service units one fighting against another one over some mistaken idea that somebody owns this information, because nobody does. Why? Yes, they do. You do. When a broken down picture such as that, if that came to pass, if the organizations in fragments, no service, the technologies diluted to suit somebody's ego or something somewhere, if these things occurred, of course these results would happen slowly. But whatever happens, it will happen. Now, we can build with technology, or we can hand it over in fragmentary form
to people who do not understand it and let them destroy with it. Because if you can rehabilitate the freedom of an individual by knowing many technologies, let me assure you that you can reduce that freedom by the misuse of the same technology. So therefore, there is a little bit of danger in sort of sitting back and saying, well, it'll all sort of come out right in the end, whether we do anything right about it or not. This is not my responsibility, not my responsibility, not my responsibility. By the way, there's a theme song that goes that way. It's played to the tune of many societies' anthems. And the words are always, that's not my responsibility. Well, an individual's responsibility can be raised to a point where he'll stand up and realize that we can achieve a goal for ourselves. We can achieve a wider goal for the society. We will have undoubtedly a better civilization in which to live. The goals of Scientology, then, to that degree, are your goals. What do you want to do with what you know? Fortunately, the one huge, overpowering curse that has lain upon man has been his feeling of enmity with his fellows. He believes there's something terribly wrong in trusting his fellow man. We get Alexanders and Napoleons, Hitlers, Stalins, Huey Longs. These people, to a large degree, are trying to benefit their society, the culture in which they live. They think they are. They think they're quite sincere. And yet at the same time, they are playing this game called the only one. And they're playing it to such a degree that nobody else can get on the team. The German nation, for instance, surges forward with a statement that it is a Superman. It is the Superman. And that all else in Europe is not Superman. And that the rest of Europe is going to be in a junior or slave state to Germany. And on this proposition, they finally burned Hitler with kerosene or gasoline. An awful lot of men died, and it wasn't any fun. You see, that's the only thing wrong with war on a mass production basis. It just isn't any fun. It's stand around and wait and be bored. But that's the only thing that's wrong with war. It's boredom. But when you get... Hurry up and wait, we used to say. When you get an individual or a large mass of people who are suddenly sold completely on the idea that all they have to do is reduce to slavery the rest of the world to make the rest of the world happy, we have a chaotic state. Man can be happy without that sort of thing happening. It adds just a little bit more activity into his environment than he himself can easily tolerate. I know the last time I was trying to stop shells with my bare hands, it just didn't stop them. It was upsetting, too. I mean, the randomity. You get turn a lot of fellows loose with this gunpowder, I used to tell my men. You turn people loose with this gunpowder and stuff like that, and you know somebody gets hurt. It's fantastic. I don't know what these nations are coming to. They let people run out here with guns and things like that and shoot at other people and so on because a body just can't play. You see, that's all that's wrong with that is that the body is just a bad catcher's mitt. It doesn't make a good bulletproof vest. Now, I know these people, these recruiting sergeants go around and try to sell people the idea that nobility is a good bulletproof vest, but it's not. I've tried it on. Didn't let anybody shoot at me, though, while I had it on. Now, the goals of Scientology might or might not wisely include a betterment in this anarchy of nations, which brings about war. Might or might not wisely include a wipeout of insanity. But wisdom itself is of two kinds, and one of those is wisdom which serves to enslave, and wisdom which serves to set men free. Now, it can be used either way. To a large degree, an individual knowing these technologies has a certain responsibility. He has a certain responsibility to himself, and he has a certain responsibility to those around him. It isn't that he has to carry all of society on his back and sacrifice himself and suffer forevermore and forevermore and forevermore. That is not the point. We're not even vaguely interested in you as an individual picking up all the cares and burdens of the society and struggling forward with them. But we are very interested in you as an individual using what you know when the opportunity arises that you should use what you know. You don't have to go out of your way to find trouble in this world at this time. It comes looking for you. As a matter of fact, for a long time it's had my address. I've even fixed up my telephone so it's unlisted, and then even took out the telephone. But it still appears. I try to take care of it to the degree that I can and still lead a happy life. And most of you do the same thing. We are at best a small number of people who know these things. And the only danger in knowing them is in remaining a small number of people. It's not really very safe to know these things. If, let's say, you as an individual happen to be the only one on the face of earth who knew all these things, and it was known that you knew them, well, you think, gee, that, you know, everything goes on an inversion. You say to yourself, gee, that'd be a wonderful, interesting thing to just be the only one who know this and just perform these miracles and do this. You'll get tired of it in 28 hours a day. Let me assure you, you'll get tired of it if you were the only one. Wear you out. You'd go looking for somebody to tell them to. But there's something else that comes in. It wouldn't be safe. It wouldn't be safe for the information, because you might depart this life and as yourself not readily pick up and put into a state of communication another mock-up. Information might be lost. And in view of the fact that you, in a very short space of time, would be sitting by the bedside of somebody you thought that it was up to you to make well, or you were in a group that was trying to accomplish certain goals and you thought they ought to accomplish them, and you had permitted the information to be fogged up, or you weren't willing to use it, or you had hidden it, or something of the sort, gosh, you'd feel very disenfranchised. You see, the information wouldn't be there. No, it's much safer to put the information on a lot of shelves someplace so that if you get absent-minded and shove off and leave a mock-up, you'll always be able to come back and pick it up again. You'll need this information sooner or later on the track. Now, one of the astronomic lecturers of the present age, I think it was Einstein, was standing on a lecture platform, and he said, according to calculation, the world will live approximately another 99 billion years. And fellow stood up in the back of the audience and he waved his hand very frantic about it. And finally the speaker, Einstein, recognized him, and the fellow said, "How many years did you say?" And Einstein said, 99 billion. And the fellow in the audience said, "Gee, I thought you said 99 million. Well, it's an even longer look than all of this. It's an even longer look than this for you. You try to be dead so you won't be bored, but what's the idea of being in such a state that you can be bored? We'll get back to boredom. Goals. If a fellow thinks that he can be bored, and the most horrible thing there is being bored by something, why, he will try to take measures to keep that from happening. He'll do almost anything. Well, it's interesting that the emotion is a false one. It's interesting that the emotion called boredom is a frantic state of not being able to do anything about it. That's all. That's all boredom is. Not able to do something about it. And an individual hits that time after time after time in life, and well, he can't do anything about it. And he has to quit because he doesn't know what to do. That's boredom. An individual who runs into this while you're processing him, and you in these group processes are probably going to run into it. Well, just chew right on through it, because there isn't any, it isn't one of these things which lasts forever. What you're actually running out when you hit boredom is, I can't do anything about it, and nobody else can do anything for me. Now, that's boredom. And when you hit that, it runs out. And what is on the other side of that? It, boredom is like a great door that is slammed in the face of any man trying to live. He starts up to the door, interested in life, interested in doing something, interested in the efforts which he's putting forward, and then the thought occurs to him, maybe I'll get into a situation where it'll get too much for me, and I won't be able to do anything about it, and so he turns away. If you could conceive a great river running, turning around, pouring down gorges and carrying on straightforwardly to the sea, there's a lot of power in it. If you could conceive that river suddenly and abruptly being turned into an area which would block it forevermore, and it would just stand there and eddy idly, and any debris it was carrying or anything like that would just float there idly and turn, and it would just sit there to the end of time, and it would never more rush onto the sea. You have an idea what boredom is. Well, what keeps that river from rushing onto the sea? The fact that a barrier has been imposed between it and the sea. And that barrier is the idea that one can't. And when this barrier is too powerfully erected, the individual even starts in that direction, and he's all of a sudden gets this sense of, I can't, or I will be helpless in that situation. And he no longer carries on with his goals. He no longer goes forward with his projects. And then he's bored. There is no greater boredom than the child who is not permitted to go outside on a beautiful day. He's inside. He's bored. Why is he inside and bored? Why is he bored? It's because he can't go outside. What doesn't permit him to go outside? The door. Mama. Therefore, he is unable to have a greater mobility. And so his protest against this is boredom. He'll sit and be bored, too. You can even remember the first time you made up your mind to be bored. Now, I've seen a little child with practically no toys, but also with nothing being erected in front of him as a barrier which tells him he can't, actually sit for hours and just fool around with a ball or something like that, perfectly happy, make up various games with this ball, very, very cheerful about it, and never occur to the child to be bored. Never occur to him either, really, to have a fantastic need of playmates. Just happy about the whole thing. And somebody comes along and says, you can't throw the ball up against that wall. So he throws it up against the wall and promptly is beaten back by the enemy troops and decides, well, it's all right. After a while, he can't, so he goes down in tone about it, and finally in apathy, having been spanked 8 times, he doesn't throw the ball up against there anymore. He starts throwing it up against another wall and bouncing it back, and that wall is lost to him at last, and he goes into apathy about that wall. And then he starts throwing it against the third wall of the room. The same thing happens in the fourth wall of the room. He won't even touch the fourth wall of the room. But if he were perfectly healthy, and this had never happened to him too often, if it hadn't happened to him too often, well, he'd still keep playing with the ball a little bit. And then somebody would come along and say, you can't play with a ball. he's thereafter bored. He's blocked on every side. He can't go in any particular direction. He has to sort of eddy, and this expresses itself in sighs and groans and so forth. Well, the next day, we give him a ball. He doesn't play with it. He sits there, bored. But the day before, he wasn't bored playing with this ball. What intervenes? It isn't that over a certain span of time, an individual has to do new things continuously. That's not true. An individual doesn't need continuously hectic new entertainments, hectic new activities, new goals of this sort and that sort and so on. That's not necessary. It's only when he can no longer have these goals, when they've been taken away from him, when the walls have been taken away from him, you might say, when the ball has been taken away from him, that he has to have something new. Why? To take his mind off the fact that he has been walled in. Take his mind off of that fact. He has a fact now he's trying to avoid. Why is he trying to avoid that fact? Well, punishment stands back of that fact. So he's trying to avoid the punishment. So he's trying to avoid the fact. So now he has to have hectic new entertainments. God help some of these parents who have carefully educated their children into cant. These parents drive down the road. They're going on a trip, you see, and driving along, and they've got Junior and daughter in the back seat and so on. And everything's going to be just fine. Everything's just going to be wonderful on this trip. Except Junior keeps saying, "Yeah, I want an ice cream cone, and why don't we stop? And look, there's a place that sells rocks, and there's another place that sells something, and they have to do this, and they have to do that, and they have to have, please give me, I want, I've got to, yap, 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 yap." And finally, Papa feels like blowing his brains out, but that's not allowed in the society, so he doesn't. And he just keeps putting him back in the back seat and saying, "Sit there, you can't have, you can't have, you can't do, you can't have," just continuously, see. All he's doing is he's saying, you see, you can't be there. You can't do it over again. So he's fixing them up so they'll always be hectic, so they'll always bother him, so he'll always demand something new and be completely hungry, starved for parental attention. Mama will not ever be permitted to sit still. The children will be in there hammering and pounding at her. Why? Because they can't. They can't. They have to attack these barriers because these barriers stand between them and interest. And so evermore they have to have new entertainments. New this, new that, new interests. And after a while they run out of new interests to have. And they just go flat in life. And after that, life doesn't have very much to offer them. Why? Because life's all full of barriers, of course. Because in essence, life is a game composed of barriers. It's a game composed of barriers. Individuals set up certain purposes, and those purposes actually consist of barriers. The barriers of time, of space, walls. Individuals who read a book are setting up a barrier of 300 or 500 pages between themselves and the end, and they go through the book to the end of the barrier. They like to do it. Happiness could be defined as the overcoming of not unknowable obstacles toward a known goal. In other words, not too many barriers, but enough barriers. And an individual has to be super interested continuously in direct ratio to the degree they have been denied things to be interested in. And if a person's been denied enough things to be interested in, they're fresh out of goals. Their dreams are dead. They're dead. And so we get a condition in life where boredom itself stands there as a wall. If they start in any particular direction, they're afraid that they will be told they can't have it. They can't arrive. So they don't arrive. And they stop arriving less and less, less and less. You ask them as a pre-clear, grab hold of the two back anchor points of the room, and they can come within a foot of the corners, but not entirely to the corners. They don't dare arrive. They rationalize this in numerous ways. They say, I don't dare arrive because if I arrive, then there would be nothing further to do. In the field of writing, we had a fellow by the name of Gibbon who wrote for many years a book called The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. At the end of that time, he finished writing the book. He just went home quietly and died. He had no trouble at all arriving. He just went home and died. But he'd done everything that he'd wanted to do. This has happened many, many times in life, but there wasn't any particular reason why he couldn't have turned around and written The Decline and Fall of the Persian Empire. Well, why couldn't he have turned around and done what I wish he'd done many times? Why didn't he write the Origin and Republic of the Roman Empire? That's missing, you know. Almost anybody can come along and say, this is the condition that existed 500 B.C. in the Roman Empire, because they didn't have Gibbon on it. That's all. So the fellow fell down. I mean, he wrote the wrong end of the book, and every once in a while I say, I wish he'd written the front end of the book. Then we'd know something about it without having to go back and dive into the bank and get all those times when one was killed as a decemvir. Anyway, his arrival was very positive. And he actually denied us a piece of literature. The difficulty that a person encounters is just the difficulty of a barrier. And with an individual, it becomes an unseen barrier. What sort of a barrier is it? He doesn't know. Because he can't look at it. And that's how it became a barrier. He's not been permitted to look at it. And if he's been refused a lookingness at it long enough, he doesn't see it at all. You come along and you say to him, pretty clear, you say, well, now, did your father ever beat you? Oh, yes, just hundreds of times. E-meter sits there, doesn't even twitch. You say, your mother ever beat you? And, no. Mother was always good to me. E-meter just fell 15 dials. He's mixed up. His mother was so bad to him that he can't even look at her. You ask him for a mock-up of Mama, he just gets a blank. It must have been Papa that was mean to him because he can't look at Mama. You see, he's just shifted his barrier, so he doesn't know anymore what barrier he is confronting. And that in itself is the basic confusion of the individual. The emotion of confronting an unknown or unknowable, the individual feels it's unknowable, and actually these barriers until this time have been unknowable. The emotion of confronting it is simply the emotion of boredom. Well, now that's a very, very, very extremely bad thing to talk to you about here at the first hour of this Congress, boredom. Because I noticed there as you're sitting there, your feet twitch. Because it's really not a bad thing, boredom. It's just not bad because it will run out. Now an individual is processed toward that process, toward that goal of running out of boredom. And you as an auditor may very often expect to have to sit there and fight him to keep him on the couch long enough to run it out. No, he doesn't want to go to that anymore. It doesn't make any difference to him anymore. No. Why? You're remorselessly shoving him straight at and through all the imaginary barriers which he thinks intervene between him and his goals. And if you allow yourself to be fought off by avoiding boredom, or if you yourself are so frightened of boredom as an auditor that you won't audit it out of somebody else, nobody's going to get well. It's an interesting thing that in Spain they have in their bullfights the most monotonous program you ever saw. I mean, the matadors and the picadors and so forth, they come out and then they let the bull in and then they go through certain jabs and dives, and it's all very adroit and it's very pretty. And after you've seen it once, you've seen it once. It would fix up an American audience. An American audience would sit there and they'd say for the first two fights, gee, gosh, that's really terrific. The third fight, they'll say, hey, wait a minute. Fourth fight, they'd say, huh. Well, gee, Well, maybe the next fight will be better. I'll get the next fight in the series. You know, I'm talking about this. They have 6, 8 of them in one afternoon. Run right out to the other. They'd say, gosh, holy cats, I'm bored. Can't stand that repetition. Spaniards can. They just sit there, hooray, and so on. You say, well, they know all the nuances and the differences. No, they don't. I read a little manual on bullfighting, knew more about bullfighting than the people around me. In fact, I had to inform a couple of them what the passes were and so forth. Not that. The point is they couldn't stand this monotony. Because they can't remain in one place. They know they can't remain in one place. Something's going to shove them off of it. So if you can't remain in one place, you can't look at the same thing over and over 2 or 3 times. So an individual hectically has to have something new, 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 something new, and something new again. Has to have a different bullfight. I suppose the second fight, an American would demand that they came out with the bandoleros stabbed in the back of the bull and the matador doing a handstand on one of the bandoleros. Yeah, it must have to be something like that. To show you the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, it probably went this way. The Romans probably at first glance were perfectly willing to sit and watch two-a-day vaudeville. You know, I mean, same acts, and they'd come around the Keith Orpheum circuit there in Rome, and there'd be two same acts, and a few months later they'd go down and they'd say, say, you know, Joe Frisco is on down there, they'd say, over from Greece. And he's down there. Let's go down and see his act. They know what the act is. They've seen it 5 times. But they go down and they watch Joe Frisco. He does a soft shoe on a lion or something. And they watch this act, and they're perfectly content about it. They say, gee, he was pretty good this time. That's fine. Yeah. Real comfortable. Well, toward the later, the end of the Roman Empire, while they're going down there, and they heard from somebody what Joe Frisco's act was, and so in essence they had to that degree seen it, so they didn't want to go near it. They had to have a new act. You know, new acts, new acts, new acts. And finally, complete downfall just before the Roman Empire entirely caved in, and there were 2 wolves was the total population of the Forum. By the way, that happened in 526. The total population of Rome was 2 wolves in the Forum. Just before that occurred, they were turning on TV sets. That's just as close to complete randomity as you can get. I mean, not only are all the plots different, there aren't any there. I've heard later days of the Roman Empire, I heard some of the citizens complaining very much. They said that the Boogie Woogie beer ads were being repeated. They said that commercial was used for a week without any change at all, and it almost drove them mad. Afraid to stay in one place, afraid to be fixed in one place. They have to move, have to get away, get out, get under, do something, change it, change it, change it. Why? Well, they know that at any moment, if they go through the same cycle of action that they went through before, they're going to be stopped. Why? They've always been stopped on past cycles of action, so if they go through the same cycle, then they can be predicted and stopped. What do you suppose a person's opinion of his fellow man is who believes this can happen? But every time he goes through the same cycle of action, he's going to be stopped. Pretty rugged. He can't stay in one place. All right, you run this pre-clear, and you say, all right, now let's go to the beginning of the engram, and let's run through the end of the engram. And he starts through it, and he gets through it all right. And you say, all right, let's go to the beginning of the engram again, and he starts running a different engram. He said, wait a minute, let's get that first engram. Well, he's already started to run this second engram, and you've interrupted him, so he goes to a third engram. So he can't stay in one place. Why? If he does, he'll be shot. He knows what he's done to people in life. He knows he deserves it. He can't stay in one place. He always has to have something new. In other words, he has to go to new places. These things are data of equal magnitude. So he can't stay in the same place, and he always has to have something new. He has to go to other places. Now, that might not be too intelligible at the moment, but just add it up in your minds, and you'll find out that an individual who has been blocked off from achieving a goal normally believes then that he must have new goals. And the goals he really wants in life are the goals he postulated in the first place. And it's very, very funny to find some young fellow who decided at the age of 8 to be a good trumpet player. to find him after you've processed him, not necessarily being a professional trumpet player, but returning to the idea that it'd be a lot of fun to be a trumpet player. Not because he just postulated once, because that was what he wanted to do. He finally became a book salesman. Then he went to work for the government, and then they made him a cabinet minister. And he did all sorts of boring things, in other words. Unfinished cycles of action. This messed universe continues and persists as a place of torment for an individual only so long as these unfinished cycles of action obtain. So what are goals? Let's finish a cycle of action. Let's just finish one once. So let's get clear with Congress. Okay, let's take that.